The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why was Papua New Guinea an important location during World War II?
You know, most of the air war stories that you hear in the news and read stories about and see in videos, Memphis Belle is an example, they're all over the European war theater and the fight against Germany and the flights over the English Channel. When in a lot of the incredible fights protecting Australia took place over Papua New Guinea, and more airplanes were shot down, enemy and allied aircraft, over PNG per square mile than anywhere else on the planet. They figure that over 2,000 planes were shot down in the jungles of Papua New Guinea, and most of them have not been found to this day. And when the heavy rains come, the bones of the crew members will still float to the surface, and hence the name of my book, Jungle of Bones.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors who write from and about the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with children's author Ben Michelson about his novel Jungle of Bones. Jungle of Bones is a novel for readers ages 8 through 12. It's a story about Dylan Barstow, who blames others, in particular his father, for all of his problems. Explain why Dylan is so angry.
Dylan feels abandoned. His father was a war correspondent in Darfur and was killed bringing aid to, the needy people there and the people who were very much victims of genocide there. And Dylan thinks of his father as not having needed to be there, that he had abandoned his family when, in fact, his father had just answered a higher calling and cared very much about Dylan. But after his father's death, then Dylan became angry, having been feeling abandoned by a father that he was very close to. And it was that started bringing on his juvenile behavior.
And so at the beginning of the book, he is 11?
Yes.
He acts out by disobeying his mother and also by committing petty crimes. So let's hear a passage in which he goes a little bit too far.
It was after dark when Dylan's mother finally returned. He could hear her busying around the downstairs for almost an hour. Before going to bed, she poked her head into Dylan's room to make sure he was home. "What's wrong? Don't you trust me?" Dylan shouted as his mother closed the door. She retreated down the stairs without even saying hello. Dylan's face flushed with anger. Why did she treat him like some little kid who needed babysitting? He would be in eighth grade this fall, yet she always acted like he was some screw-up who was about to set the house on fire. Dylan crossed the room. If she wanted a screw-up, he would really give her one. He eased his window open and crawled out onto the porch roof. He whispered back, "Zipper, stay." Dylan could hear Zipper whining as he carefully tiptoed down the shingles and over to where a big maple tree grew near the gutter downspout. With practiced ease, he lowered himself to the ground. He didn't know where he was going. He just began walking. When he reached the end of the block, an idea struck him. He quickened his pace and he ran the next six blocks to the edge of town, where he squeezed under a wood-slatted fence that guarded the front of the local junkyard. Often, when he skipped school, he came out here to wander around the junk cars. He loved cars, any kind of car, antiques, hot rods, sports cars. He especially liked Corvettes. That had been his dad's favorite car. Dylan could tell just about every model that had ever been made. Not that there were any Corvettes in this junkyard, but there were other old cars that were pretty awesome. Whenever Dylan wandered through this junkyard, the owner, a guy called Mance Crogan, watched him as if he thought a crook was trying to steal something. To bug the owner, Dylan always walked extra slowly. During one of his visits, Dylan had noticed six or seven cars parked away from the others in a row alongside the garage. He asked about them, and Mance said they had been fixed up to run and were for sale. When Dylan looked inside the cars, he noticed keys in all the ignitions. That was something he remembered now as he crossed the darkened yard. He walked straight to an old gray Plymouth in the middle of the row. A dim yard light cast eerie shadows from each car. Peering in, Dylan saw a keychain dangling from the car's ignition. He took a step back from the Plymouth and stood up straight. Maybe this wasn't such a good idea. He looked around at the empty and quiet lot. Most people were fast asleep by now, including his mom. If he just took the car for a quick ride and returned it, how would anybody know it was him? Dylan tried the driver's door. He expected it to be locked, but the handle clicked and the door swung open with a creak. Dylan took this as a sign and crawled inside. Fumbling in the darkness, he stepped on the clutch, shifted it into neutral, and he turned the key. The engine cranked several times before the old Plymouth growled to life. Dylan revved the engine. Grinning with nervousness, he slowly shifted the car into reverse and backed away from the building. A freshly plowed field surrounded the junkyard, looking like a moonscape in the dim light. Dylan floored the gas pedal and popped the clutch, spinning the tires all the way down the gravel drive that circled the yard. When he reached the field, he twisted the steering wheel to the right and heard the twang of wire as the big car plowed through the fence. Dylan left the lights off. The dim moon made the field look foreboding. Dylan imagined zombies appearing. This far from the highway, on a dark night, Dylan doubted that anybody would even see or hear him. He shifted into second and floored the gas pedal again. The old Plymouth roared as it bounced across the deep furrows. Again and again, the shock absorbers bottomed out, jarring the whole car. Dylan laughed as he spun the wheel and began spinning circles. Dylan called it cutting donuts. Careening around in circles made the dry dirt kick up. Soon a cloud of dust blocked even the half moon from witnessing his joyride. In total darkness, Dylan kept the gas pedal pressed to the floor. His mom would be having a batch of kittens if she knew that her little boy was out spinning donuts in a farmer's field. Dylan closed his eyes and tilted his head back. Keeping the gas pedal floored, he smiled. Life was good. It was nearly 5 minutes before Dylan opened his eyes again. He noticed a flicker of red through the thick cloud of dust and let up on the gas pedal. As the dust cleared, the moonlight returned along with a set of headlights. Without the motor revving, Dylan could also hear a siren now. He straightened out the steering wheel and carefully drove out of the vanishing dust cloud. Facing Dylan waited two patrol cars, red lights flashing, sirens wailing. "Stop the car and get out with your hands up!" an amplified voice shouted over a loudspeaker on top of one of the squad cars. "Get out now!" Bright headlights blinded Dylan as he braked to a stop and shut off the engine. That was bad. His plan hadn't been to get caught. He panicked. Maybe he could jump out and run. In the darkness, the officers probably couldn't catch him, but before Dylan could do anything, a deputy ran to the side of the old Plymouth. He jerked the door open and drew his pistol. "Get out with your hands up," he shouted. Dylan turned the ignition off and raised his hands. An eerie silence hung in the air along with dust. As he crawled slowly from the car, I was just having a little fun," he stammered, holding his hands above his head. He recognized the deputy. "Put your hands on the hood and spread your legs," the deputy demanded. Now an officer from the other squad car ran up. He grabbed Dylan's hands one at a time, and he twisted them behind his back to snap on a pair of handcuffs. "You call this a little fun? Wrecking somebody's car, running down a fence, and ripping up somebody's planted field?" "I'll pay for it," Dylan argued, his voice shaking. The handcuffs bit into his wrists. "You bet you will," the deputy answered. Dylan kicked at the dirt in frustration as the officer led him through the clouds of dust back to the patrol car.
At the detention center, Dylan recognizes some of the officers and his surroundings as familiar because he's been there many times before. But this time, things are a little bit different. His mother doesn't come and get him right away, and he's there overnight, and he realizes that he's done something serious this time. So explain what happens to him.
Well, his mother realizes that he's out of control, and that she needs help from the outside. Dylan, of course, he thinks he can manipulate his mother to do anything. He uses a mother's love as his ace in the hole. And in many ways, he can manipulate her. But she turns to their uncle, Todd, as somebody to bring a little bit of male influence into Dylan's life. And their uncle, Todd, he's been a Marine all of his life. And Dylan knows that he can't manipulate his uncle. And so that's where the whole thing starts. He's sent off to Portland, Oregon for the summer to spend the summer with his uncle, Todd. Now, Uncle Todd has just finished settling the estate of Dylan's grandfather, who was a crew member of a B-17 bomber during the Second World War. And they find a little journal that their grandfather wrote when he was trying to survive in the jungles for 2 weeks after the crash of the B-17 bomber. Now with modern methodry like infrared imaging and with GPS and all this, and with the clues that are given in the journal, they think possibly they could go and find the wreckage now. And so he takes Dylan over to Papua New Guinea for the summer to try to look for this B-17 bomber called Second Ace that went down. And Dylan, of course, he has no intention whatsoever of going over to Papua New Guinea for the summer, but in fact, he does end up going, and the adventure begins.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with children's author Ben Michelson. We're chatting about his novel, Jungle of Bones. If you tuned in late or would like to share this program with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. It's also posted at our Facebook page. After a short break, we'll find out how Dylan got himself lost in the jungle. Don't go away. In Portland, the first thing that Uncle Todd makes him do is go out and start running to try to get him in shape because they have 2 weeks before they leave. He's also supposed to be taking some malaria pills so he doesn't get sick. So tell what he does with those.
Well, he flushes them down the toilet. And because he has no intention of going over to PNG, he thinks he'll not need these malaria pills. So he flushes them down the toilet, which ends up being his downfall, because when he gets lost in the jungles of Papua New Guinea, he contracts malaria, and some of his illusions and nightmares and everything that he has over there as a result of the malaria become instrumental in the story and his waking up to reality.
He's also not a very environmentally aware kid if he would flush drugs down the toilet, because that's not good for fish.
Yeah. I guess I work with a lot of juvenile detention centers, and I work around a lot of very angry young people. And I have to admit that the environment of our planet is probably the last thing on these kids' minds.
Exactly.
But you are very, very correct.
Mm-hmm. So Uncle Todd's version of Dylan's summer vacation is quite different from what he actually wants to do. And he's a kid with a lot of attitude, and his mother is trying to get him to be respectful. And that seems to be somewhat of the theme throughout the book.
Two things played into this. I was at a couple of parades, and I was also at a couple of stock car races, and I was at a couple of other events where a bunch of teenagers were standing around, and when they stand up and have the passing of the flag, or they have the Pledge of Allegiance, or this, you know, these kids continued joking between themselves, never removed their covers, their hats, showed no respect at all for the flag. And I've seen that happening more and more and more, and I look at that and I think, well, the only thing that could possibly allow that is a lack of recognition of what went into the freedom that allowed them to be in the stands laughing and joking with each other at that moment. And so that bothered me a little bit. I'm not this big flag-waving patriot out there, but I also realize that there is a time and a place to recognize how special our existence is here in the United States. And to that, I was a person that was never born and raised here. I was born and raised down in Bolivia, South America. I've been to countries where death squads come in the middle of the night and you have to whisper to only one or two people that you trust about anything that is anti-government or you know, against local leaders. And I've seen that lack of freedom, and for these teenagers to take that for granted bothered me. And I also am a pilot, and I've spent many, many, many summers flying my planes to Oshkosh, Wisconsin for the big Experimental Aircraft Association fly-in there. And the warbirds of America are always present there, and they have big flyovers, and they recount the wars that were fought by the Tuskegee Airmen and a lot of the B-25 and B-17 bomber crews. And I've sat and visited with these old men and their recounting of their missions, and I wanted to communicate that in a book also. Mm-hmm. And the third thing, and I will add this, I travel a lot as an author. I probably spend 5 months a year on the road in schools. And I go into schools and I see a lack of respect. And I don't care what kids do. I really don't. Many schools will allow hats to be worn in school. They allow lowrider pants, and they just, I don't have any problem with any of that if why they do it is because it's more comfortable or because it's the latest style. All of us did that when we were growing up, wanted to be like all the other kids. But when I see it being done to thumb their nose, you know, at the adults because they know it makes adults angry, I have a problem with that. And that's instrumental in the book between Uncle Todd and Dylan. I mean, you know, he criticizes Dylan for wearing his pants so low. Well, Dylan criticizes Uncle Todd for wearing his pants up above his belly button, you know. And why do you wear them so high? And he says, well, because they'll fall off otherwise. He said, but it's not because I disrespect you, he tells Dylan. So that theme plays out in the book.
A day or two before they go to the jungle, Uncle Todd takes Dylan over to meet a man in a nursing home, Frank. And Frank tells Dylan his story, which was that he flew 25 bomber missions during World War II. Say why that was significant.
The average crew member in that Pacific War theater lived through 6 or 7 missions. That was the average life expectancy of a crew member back then. If you ever, ever lived through 25 missions, you became a member of an elite club called, and this was the official title, was called the Lucky Bastards Club. And you automatically got to go fly back to the United States, and you were away from being in the war zone. And old Frank, he'd been lucky enough to live through 24 missions, but on his last mission, he survived, but he was wounded very badly, and he came back, and he tells about that mission coming back after bombing a bearing factory over in Germany and being attacked.
And even after all those decades, it was still hard for him to tell that story.
I interviewed probably 12 crew members from these old missions. And incidentally, they're almost an extinct breed of people. By that, I mean Back then, the crew members were very, very young. 18 to 22 years old was the average time, and you have to realize this took place in the early 1940s. So do your math, and now all of these crew members that are still surviving, and there's maybe 2% of them, 1 or 2%, are in their early 90s. So they're another 5 years from now, we will have lost those incredible stories that came from these old men. And they came back from the war to a country that didn't want to hear their stories. And in many cases, they didn't want to tell them because it was dredging up memories that were horrific. And so for me, it was a very gentle process and very cautious process of talking to these old men and slowly, slowly let them open up. Don't push. Just slowly show interest and be sincere. And then I started hearing, and I heard from some of the wives that this was the first time they had ever heard their husbands open up completely. And so I feel like I had heard stories that had never been heard before. And I wanted to put them all together, compile them into a story that came as an example from Frank in the nursing home.
And in your author notes, you say that you got from those interviews a really strong sense that freedom is never free.
Yeah, I am a little bit of a history buff. I knew a lot about the early, you know, the air wars, especially because I'm a pilot and I had the interest in that. And I knew that freedom was never free. But when I heard the in-person recounting of these missions and holding a dying comrade in your arms and them bleeding out on your lap, and I started realizing, you know, the consequences. There are some people who say, hey, you know, never go to war, never raise a hand in anger, and the a little bit of the Quaker type of attitude toward peace I couldn't agree more, except that I'm not naive enough to also think that had somebody not stood up to a man called Hitler, perhaps you and I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation anymore. And I was talking to a friend of mine a while back who is very, very much against any war of any kind. And he said, "You don't know that, Ben." He said, "Prove that to me." And I said, "Well, the only proof I have is I just finished a month ago going through the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., and I said, I think there were 3 million Jews that are my proof that freedom is never free. And that's getting a little melodramatic, but I do believe it.
Well, as we said, in spite of all Uncle Todd's efforts to keep him safe and healthy in their trek through the jungle, Dylan continued to ignore his instructions, which eventually had some dire consequences. So let's hear a passage about that. But first, tell us what Dylan did in the jungle right before this happened.
Well, his uncle had not allowed him to bring his headphones with because he said, this summer is not about escaping reality. You put those headphones on to tune out the world, and this summer is not about tuning out the world. This summer is about going out and exploring, discovering, and being a part of the world. And so Dylan snuck his headphones along. And one absolute thing, when you went away from the group, even a little ways to go to the bathroom in the jungle, you kept your survival kit with you. And Dylan, of course, he doesn't need a survival kit. You're just going to walk a little ways away from the group. And of course, then he puts his headset on, his headphones on, and he starts listening to some music, and he doesn't hear the thunder overhead. And he starts walking away from the group, angry at them because he doesn't want to, have his uncle babysit him. And he gets further and further down the trail, and the further he gets, the more free he feels because he's thumbing his nose at the group and all of their rules. And pretty soon it starts to rain, but what's a little bit of rain? And that turns into a downpour, and pretty soon he can't remember which path he took and where his footprints were that returned to the group. And when he finally pulls his headset off, he can't shout into the thunder and the downpouring rain and be heard more than 10 feet away. And then, of course, he becomes lost.
And then this happens.
Dylan slogged through the swamp toward the trees. He needed to find dry ground where he could spend the night again. Still, he watched for snakes and crocodiles. The air reeked of rotting undergrowth. All day he had seen birds, rats, possums, and other animals to eat, but no way to catch them. The only critters Dylan could approach were snakes and crocodiles. He knew the snakes might be poisonous, and there was no way he was going to try to catch a crocodile, even a small one. Before leaving the tall grasses, Dylan ate a few more grasshoppers and then deliberately headed for a root-tangled path entering the jungle. Soon the thick, matted screen of overhead vines and leaves muted any fading sunlight that made it through the clouds. For the next hour, Dylan stumbled along a trail, no longer looking down to pick his footing. He had to find some kind of refuge before dark, a place where he could be out in the open but on higher ground. He needed a space where he could lie down and still see wild animals approaching, hopefully a place with fewer insects. As the light faded, a brief shower of rain fell. Only a few drops penetrated the dense canopy overhead. Suddenly, a sharp pain stabbed Dylan's ankle. He glanced down in time to see a dark brown snake recoil and slither across the trail and into the undergrowth. "Ouch!" he muttered, crouching. He pulled up his right pant leg to find four small puncture wounds where the snake had sunk its fangs. Without thinking, Dylan panicked and began running down the trail. But even as he ran, he realized it was probably the dumbest thing he could ever do after a snake bite. Still, he kept running. If he stopped, he would just die here on some muddy, overgrown trail in the jungles of Papua New Guinea. By morning, rats would have picked his bones clean. By next week, other critters would have his bones scattered through the forest like twigs and branches. The world would never even know what had happened to Dylan Barstow. Dylan ran faster. He had to find protection or help. Overhead, the light had faded into darkness. Now the only light came from a hazy moon hanging in the sky like a dim light bulb. At that very instant, Dylan broke into a clearing similar to the one where he had slept the night before. He walked out away from the darkness of the trees into the moonlight and froze in shock. Ahead were rocks, and next to the rocks stood a tall spiral tree that looked like a big screw. This was the same place he had left early this morning. Without a compass, he had walked all day in a huge circle only to end up back where he had begun. Dylan blinked his eyes, as if doing so might make the stupid tree disappear. He shook his head as a wave of despair washed over him, worse than any chill or fever. Dylan screamed, desperate and primal, his voice piercing the hush that had fallen over the clearing. As he finished, tears started down his cheeks, stopping to rest each time he hiccuped with grief. And then a different spasm flooded through his body and his knees buckled. Dylan collapsed to the ground. The jungle spun in circles. He felt suddenly stiff and cold, as if his body were freezing in a blizzard. And then there was nothing.
Ben Michelson is the author of 10 books. He lives near Bozeman, Montana. You'll find more information about him as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/TWQ. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/TWQ. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.